History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. The fate of the United States and the entire Western Hemisphere was arguably shaped by a war that happened in the early 1740s, and it all began when a British captain of a merchant ship had his ear cut off by sailors of the Spanish Coast Guard when they boarded a ship to search for contraband. This captain, Robert Jenkins, 7 years after his ear was cut off, was paraded before the British Parliament without his ear in order to drum up support for this war. All this happened against a backdrop of growing tensions between the British and Spanish empires who were fighting for economic supremacy in the Americas. This was part of a number of wars that happened for a 100-year period from the War of Spanish Succession and culminating in the War of Jenkins' Ear. It resulted in the invasion of Georgia and even involved members of George Washington's own family. It would cost 50,000 lives, millions in treasure, and over 600 ships. It laid the groundwork for the French and Indian War and eventually the War of the American Revolution, engaging the major European powers on battlefields from Europe to the Americas to the Asian subcontinent. To talk about the War of Jenkins' Ear is today's guest, Robert Gowdy. He's the author of the book, The War of Jenkins' Ear, The Forgotten Struggle for North and South America, 1739 to 1742. The war was fought in many places, from Chesapeake Bay to the shores of Tierra del Fuego, from the Cape of Good Hope and across the Pacific to the Philippines and the Cantonese coast. But even though it happened decades before the American Revolution, this war was arguably the first American war. It was a struggle that determined the fate of the Americas, and for the first time, involved the participation of American armies. We look at a lot in this discussion, including how to fight a global war when your empire is half a global way and it takes months for communication to happen, if it can happen at all, how bad ideas about economics can cause wars to happen when they don't need to, specifically mercantilism, the idea that your trade can only grow at the expense of someone else's trade. So if you want your trade to grow or not shrink, you have to attack someone else who is in the same market. And how this war really created an American identity, because colonists in North America realized that their identity was becoming different and sundering from Britain. And Britain didn't necessarily have the best interests of its colonists at heart, leading to a split in identities that culminated in the American Revolution. This is an important chapter in history, and the early 18th century isn't really covered a lot, at least for Americans, and I think there's a lot that this discussion doesn't fill in the gaps. So I hope you enjoy this discussion with Robert Gowdy. Robert, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we have a lot to talk about, the nature of global warfare in the early 18th century, and an event that laid the foundation for the French and Indian War, and ultimately the conflict that birthed the United States, and arguably all the different nation states of the New World as well. But let's start out with the name of the battle, because it has a great ring to it, and I could see why it was such a great thing to use for the title of your book. So what is the War of Jenkins' Ear, and why is it called that?
So the War of Jenkins' Ear refers to a conflict that occurred in the New World between 1739 and 1742. Now, it merged into a wider global conflict. But the War of Jenkins' Ear did actually involve the ear of a man named Jenkins. He was a British sea captain, a merchant captain, and his ear was severed by Spanish Coast Guard privateers, and he was tortured. And so this was one of the inciting incidents in that war.
Well, let's take a look now, because this is in the early 18th century, and I'd love to know more about this time period, because for my audience, which is about 80 to 90% American, which what my podcast analytics tell me, this is sort of a black hole, because we, of course, know the discovery of the New World. We jump into the formation of the colonies in the early 1600s. But then we really jump into the events in the decades immediately prior to the American Revolution. But what is happening in the New World in the early 18th century? I know that some colonies are gaining steam. The plantations from Virginia or the Puritan colonies up in Massachusetts are starting to move inland a little further. There's failed colonies like the Scottish New Caledonia and Panama that ultimately dies out because the ecology is very different.
So what's happening? So this is 1739. So there's been a sort of a general-ish peace since the War of Spanish Succession, which ended in 1715. Now, the War of Spanish Secession established a few things, one of them being the awardee of the Asiento de Negros, which was the contract to sell slaves to the Spanish colonies. So this was won by Great Britain because of their role in the War of Spanish Secession. Now, at this time in the colonies, you had 12 of the original 13, I believe, or maybe 11. In any case, Georgia was just founded in 1733. Okay, it was founded as a colony of worthy debtors. And it was also founded as a anti-slave. No slavery, no lawyers, which is a good thing. No rum, which is bad. And no Catholics, which leaves me out. So in any case, so you had at that time, the French, the Spanish, and the English vying for control of the New World. And specifically vying for control of North America. Now, the Spanish had had South America locked up since the conquistadors, but their hold was shaky. Mismanagement, inbred monarchs, you know, vast jungles. They basically had a very thin presence in South America. So the British were determined to wrest South America from Spain and almost succeeded in this war.
Oh, I'm curious. The waging of transcontinental warfare in the early 18th century, this has to be a very decentralized affair just because of how long it takes communication to happen. The analogy I thought of is, you know, two moon colonies from America and China fighting each other, where the central command is far away and they really can't do much to control things. So how much independence would an admiral or a captain have on the ground? And how would Britain or Spain try to prosecute a war like this that's happening on the other side of the world when it can take weeks to get there? Orders can get muddled and may not arrive at all. So, yeah, what is warfare like on the other side of the globe at this period in history?
Basically, the captains, and this was largely a naval war. There was the great siege of Cartagena, and then there was the invasion of Georgia. But much of the action happened at sea, and it was about the British Navy. Now, the captains were sent out by the Admiralty with their sealed orders. And when they got to where they were going, they tried to prosecute those sealed orders, and they just had to adjust to whatever was happening. And indeed, it was not possible to communicate with London. You know, So you're on your own. You're on your own, and frequently, you know, as we see, for example, with the Battle of New Orleans in 1815, you know, that war of 1812 was over, and nobody knew it. You know, because, you know, peace had been signed at the Treaty of Ghent, you know, a few months before that, the famous Battle of New Orleans. So, but in any case, so yeah, you had captains acting according to their original instructions and then adjusting their tactics as they went along. So they had a great deal of discretion. Now, there were fast sloops. So Admiral Vernon, who was the commander of the British naval forces, would send fast sloops back to England, and it would take 6 weeks to get there. And, you know, so you could get some feedback within 12 weeks, you know, that's a bit of a slow process. But now, interestingly, Vernon was now this kind of, you know, war where you had to, you know, you just went on your own based on your original instructions, trickled down to his captains, right? The captains under his control. So he was one of the first English sailors to adjust the standard fighting orders. So he said, he basically gave his captains the leeway that he had. Formerly, they had their instructions and they couldn't deviate from them. And so he penned this, addition to the fighting instructions where captains could act under their own initiative. And that was the first time that had been done. And in battles at sea.
That's really interesting because there are battles happening between, say, Spain and Portugal on the Spice Islands or the Pacific back in the 16th century. I can imagine it's created all sorts of ridiculous situations or comedy of errors when they're given specific instructions on what to do by tacticians and strategists on the other side of the globe who really have no idea what it is they're commanding their men to do. And then they either have to obey something that doesn't make sense in the moment or risk committing mutiny and being court-martialed where they return. So why do you think it took so long for people to catch up to the reality of the ground like we're seeing here?
Well, I mean, just the vast distances.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very simple. They couldn't, it took 6 weeks to get to get to England and 6 weeks to get back. And by the time those 12 weeks passed, the situation had completely changed. Mm-hmm. You know, so you had to rely on your commanders. You had to give them discretion to do what they thought necessary. Now, in the case of, I write about sort of three branches of this conflict. Maybe I should get briefly into the overall, war, the strategies and why they were fighting. So what happened was, I mentioned earlier, the Asiento de Negros. So Britain won this dreadful contract to trade slaves to the Spanish colonies. Okay. And Spain did not want to trade their own slaves. They wanted to pass that dirty work on to others. And they've been doing that since the 1500s. Now, Britain gets this contract after the victories of Marlborough in the War of Spanish Secession. And they set up a company to administer the contract, the South Sea Company. And the South Sea Company was this bizarre mishmash of public and private interests. It was a private company. The shareholders made money, but it was also government-owned partially. It was just a disaster, led to a lot of corruption. But in any case, the South Sea Company soon realized they could not make, and this is one of the great ironies of history, which is full of ironies, they could not make a profit off the slave trade at that point in history. It was just no longer profitable. You had to feed the slaves. You had to get them across the Atlantic. You had to, chains were expensive. In any case, so to make up for the loss, they were actually experiencing a business loss. The one thing the Spanish colonies really needed was manufactured goods. Now, at this time, it was the mercantile system. The Spanish colonies could only trade with the mother country, as we saw in the English colonies. That's one of the causes of the revolution. You can only trade with England, or in the case of Spanish colonies, only with Spain. So they would trade raw materials for what? Spain didn't have any manufactured goods. They wanted manufactured goods. They wanted, woven cloth, linen bolts of cloth. They wanted iron implements. They wanted, stuff like that. And England, the first industrialized nation, was making that stuff. So what they did, the South Sea Company, under cover of the slave trade, outfitted their ships as smugglers of merchandise. So they'd have a few slaves, then they'd have these fake decks, and in between the decks were spinning wheels and cloth and all this other stuff. Now, they were only allowed, again, to trade slaves. So the smuggling got so bad that Spain set up this coast guard, and it was agreed to by treaty, the Guarda Costas. And they were empowered to stop any English vessel in the Caribbean or near a Spanish colony to search them for contraband. Now, in practice, they turned into pirates. They stopped English ships. They brutalized the sailors. They tortured them because they were, in fact, hidden compartments. So they would torture the captain to find the hidden compartments where the bolts of linen were or whatever. And one of these merchantmen, Jenkins, who actually was not a smuggler, it's another one of the ironies, they stop him, they torture him. He doesn't have anything to give them. And he's like, I'm an innocent merchant. I'm not smuggling anything. He was going from Jamaica, British possession, back to England. And he had goods that he had acquired in Jamaica. It was a load of sugar. And so a particular vicious Guarda Costa captain, Don Juan Leon Defendino, tortured him, strung him up a few times, dropped him on the deck, beat up everybody, stripped everybody naked. Then they tied him to the mast, cut off his ear, and threw it back at him and said, take this to your king and tell him that if we, catch him smuggling, we're going to do the same thing to him. Now, this was, you can't insult the king. This is terrible. So anyways, this is 1731. So Jenkins, who was a master navigator, they took his instruments. They took the clothes of the sailors. They took almost everything on the ship. So he manages to cross the Atlantic. This is near Cuba in the Florida Straits. He crosses the Atlantic without charts, without a sextant, and he hits, London 8 weeks later or something. And he goes to the parliament. He goes to the king. He's presented to the king. He says, I've been, an Englishman's honor has been insulted. His ear has been cut off. They wrote it all down. Then they forgot about it. Now, 8 years later, this is 1731. 8 years later, these depredations kept mounting and mounting. The Guardacostas kept getting worse and worse. They killed some sailors. They did all this stuff. So it's really kind of some of the same reasons that the War of 1812 started. You know, Spain is stopping English ships, ransacking them. And so finally there was enough outrage in England. Now at that time, the prime minister, the famous, really the first English prime minister, Robert Walpole, was a pacifist. He said a trading country need never go to war. He did not like war. So eventually the outcry in England got so great that war happened. And so it was called the War of Jenkins' Ear, not at the time, but by the historian Thomas Carlyle 100 years later. I'm going to say, you know, he sort of a waggish stylist. He was always considered to be, you know, sort of a very, his works of history were also works of great style. And in his 12-volume History of Frederick the Great, in a footnote, he mentions the War of Jenkins' Ear. And he called it the War for Jenkins' Ear. Now, the British, I did a bunch of reading, and the Cambridge Naval History calls it the War of 1739 to 1742. You know, this is not a good title for a war.
Doesn't have nearly as good of a ring to it. I agree.
No. So the war, you know, lasted 4 years. The British initially had some strategic objectives, and they were to seize the Spanish trading cities, entrepôts, Portobello and Panama. This is where all the gold and silver that Spain took from the mines of South America, the Potosi silver mines, and ripped out of the backs of the Indians, ended up in Portobello or in Cartagena or in Cuba. So the strategy at the beginning of the war from the Admiralty was seize these outposts, stop the flow of silver to Spain. And Spain, it was like heroin for the Spanish economy. They never really had to develop their economy or build factories, because every year they had these vast treasures coming in, you know, these treasure ships full of gold. You know, they didn't have to, that's all they had to do was dig them out of the earth in South America and take it to Spain. So really this was a bad thing for the development of the Spanish, you know, economy.
It sounds like with Saudi Arabia, in a sense, in the 20th or 21st century, where they can rely on oil almost exclusively. Yeah. One other thing, too, I mean, you mentioned economics, just some other context for this war. And you mentioned mercantilism, which I know plays an important impact here. And it's amazing how much when we see something happen and we see nations or empires respond in a certain way that we think is strange, they're not necessarily responding in a wrong way. They're responding logically to their own value system and their approach to something like economics. And mercantilism, it's interesting, this idea of trade being a zero-sum game. So for example, if I'm an apricot producer and I know that Malatya, Turkey produces 90% of the world apricots, I want to declare war on Turkey so that I can have the trade rather than try to link up with this global exchange and have a rising tide that lifts all boats. But how did the views of mercantilism shape this war and cause conflict in maybe a way that would seem strange to us today?
I mean, you know, it was the system of the times, and nobody really questioned it much. Although the British, while they wanted their own colonies, the British were always cheating. You know, that's why you gotta love them. So while they insisted that their own colonies trade only with them, they wanted to trade with all the colonies of everybody else too. So they wanted to trade with the Spanish colonies. They wanted to trade with the French colonies. And the, you know, the Spain, by the terms of the Asiento, did allow one ship full of manufactured goods per year. It was called the Naviero de Permiso, you know, the permission ship. And they were allowed to have 500 tons of merchandise. So the British, of course, once again, you know, stuffed the decks with, you know, 200 more tons, and then at a distance just over the horizon have a small fleet of sloops carrying other merchandise. So the British permission ship sails into the harbor of Portobello, and they set up their trade. There was a trade fair there, and a Spanish trade fair at Portobello, Panama, and Cartagena. So the British permission ship sails in. It looks like they've sold everything in the ship, but then at night these fast sloops sail in and restock them. Like they're off on the, you know, they're off on the horizon somewhere. And so it was like this cornucopia, like the ship that kept on giving, you know. So, but yeah, but that was just the system of the time. Now, the sad thing for Spain was that she could not, because she was not developed industrial, could not fulfill the needs of her own colonies. So smuggling became a necessity, you know, for the Spanish colonies. They needed all sorts of things that Spain couldn't give them, just household implement, well, you name it, you know, that the British could. So wherever there's an appetite for smuggling, you know, witness the drug trade, you know, there will be smuggling will happen.
Right. And setting up a system where you're incentivized to raid other people and their valuable goods far away from a central authority, great recipe for piracy later on, but not to get ahead of ourselves. So there's a lot of different scenes of this war. Very far flung in location. So can you describe some of the main battles here? Why were they fought in the places they were? And what result did it have on the war?
So essentially, there was three fronts, if you will. The first was the Caribbean, Portobello, which is, again, in Panama, was a great British victory. Then there was Cartagena, which is in Colombia now. And the British, it was an unstated goal. They wanted to wrest South America from Spain. And had they taken Cartagena, it came very close. They could have done that. And the history of the world would have been different. And a lot of Spanish historians, you know, point to this. It was a Spanish victory against all odds. And when Spain was so decrepit, I mean, they couldn't even supply their cannons with gunpowder, you know, that they were just, they were, if you will, the old man of Europe at that time, you know. So that was the first front. The second front was in Georgia, you know, the future United States. Then the third front was in the Pacific. And that was more of a raiding party, if you will. Now, that's the one that really stirs the imagination, you know, the one in the Pacific, to me. The British sent six British warships, the first time in history, into the Pacific. Now, the expedition left England with 1,800 men and six ships. It returned 6 years later with 300 men and one ship. So it was punishing. So first three ships were lost going around the Horn, you know, into the Pacific. It was just, as it turns out, it was one of those once in 100-year storm years, you know, and it took them 3 months to round the Horn into the Pacific. And in that process, two ships turned back and one of them got wrecked on Tierra del Fuego, the Wager. And on that ship that got wrecked in Tierra del Fuego was Lord Byron, the poet, his grandfather. They called him Foul Weather Jack Byron because he was always, you know, sailing at the wrong time. He became an admiral later. And he wrote a really memorable account of his adventures. It took him 6 years to get back to England. And he wrote a memorable book that became a bestseller in the 18th century that influenced his grandson, the poet, to become a writer. But so that's part of that expedition. The other part, so the commander is a guy named Anson, who was one of the great British captains of his day. So he was absolutely driven to fulfill his mission. His mission, again, they handed him sealed envelopes when they left England and they left the Admiralty. They weren't allowed to open it until they got to sea. And his instructions were to sail into the Pacific, harry the Spanish colonies on the Pacific coast of South America, and seize the Manila Treasure Galleon, which was a yearly galleon that came from the Philippines, you know, full of pearls and gold and all the other stuff that they took from their colonies in the Orient. So, you know, against all odds, he actually found the treasure galleon in the middle of the Pacific. He was down to one ship, a few hundred guys, and he took the galleon. And then circumnavigated the globe, went the rest of the way back to England with his ship, the Centurion, full of, you know, bullion and all kinds of, but really a real, who's that guy that writes those sea novels, you know, Patrick O'Brien.
Right. The master and commander author.
Yeah. And I think actually, one of his earlier novels was about this expedition.
Hmm.
Yeah. Which I haven't read it.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. As an aside, at this period in the early 18th century, how dangerous is it to circumnavigate the globe? Because something like 90% of Magellan's crew died, and it's not until Captain Cook when there's a link established between vitamin C and not getting scurvy. So the charts are a little bit better, but a lot of the main problems of oceanic navigation haven't been solved yet. So how dangerous is it to do something like this?
So it's not as dangerous as it was for Magellan.
Mm-hmm.
But Anson lost something like 90% of his men too, or he lost two-thirds of his men, many of them to scurvy, which was just insidious. And interestingly, scurvy had this weird effect where old wounds would reopen. Like, so he had, you know, I should preface this by saying that England had just gone through a very bad winter, and there was a typhoid epidemic in England in like 1738. And so they had a real hard time staffing the ships, getting their complements of men. So they went to the Chelsea Hospital for Invalids, which is the military hospital in England, still there, and took these poor bastards who were like 70 years old. They'd fought in the War of Spanish Succession. They'd seen, horrific battles. They'd been wounded, and they were pensioners. And they forced them to join Anson's expedition. And a few of them, like the wounds that they had received 50 years earlier, reopened because of scurvy. I mean, it's just bizarre, and interestingly, one of those pensioners. So when Anson took the Manila galleon, most of them died like within a few months, but a few survived. One who survived had fought in the Battle of Almanza in Spain in like 1718, which is 30 years before this. And one of the officers aboard the ship that they captured had captured him in that same battle. 40 years earlier, whatever the heck it was. So just think of the coincidence of that,
Revenge is a dish best served cold.
Yeah.
You mentioned the Lord Byron's grandfather, and that's another thing too about this war, that you see lots of people, I suppose, giving cameo appearances who are related to other more famous people, including George Washington's half-brother and the namesake of his later plantation. What role do they play in the war, and is it notable beyond just who they're related to in the future?
So, a big part of this war and why it's important for later American history is, so it was the first time that a regiment of regular troops, they called it on the establishment, was raised in the colonies. Because again, England was not prepared for this war. They'd been essentially at peace for a generation. They were not ready. They didn't have enough men. They were always the English strategy. They were always worried that France was going to join in on the side of England, of Spain. And if they did that, England would be left unprotected. If they sent all their troops to the New World, England itself would be left unprotected in the case of French aggression. So they kept, half their forces at home, and they needed to fulfill their complement of men in the New World. So they commissioned a regiment, which became known as Gooch's American Legion. And he was the governor, lieutenant governor of Virginia. And it was 4,000 men with regiments representing all the colonies. Virginia, or rather battalions, representing the colonies. Virginia had two battalions. And one of those was captained by Lawrence Washington, who was George Washington's brother, older brother. Now, Lawrence was a father figure to George because he was a half-brother. Their father, Gus Washington, had died when George was 8 or 9 or something. And Lawrence was 15 years older and sort of stepped in as his surrogate father. And the only time George Washington left the continental United States was he went with his brother to Barbados when his brother was dying of smallpox and to nurse him. And that's when George got his own smallpox, when he was nursing his brother. But in any case, his brother comes back from the war. Let me preface this by saying, the American troops were treated terribly. They were treated, as they complained, like slaves. They weren't allowed to fight. They were forced to dig trenches. They were looked down upon as, papists, blacksmiths, etc. And they weren't given the uniforms they were promised. They weren't given the weapons they were promised. They weren't given the food they were promised. So in that lies one of the seeds of the revolution, in my opinion, the largest, because America realized that the mother country, they don't care about us. And keep in mind, the revolution was only, 40 years later, So anyways, Lawrence comes back. And he tells George, he comes back a broken man. He's 24 years old. As it turns out, he's got tuberculosis that he contracted during the war. He, you know, has witnessed just abusive treatment of him and his men. And he tells George, avoid foreign entanglements, you know, which is what, of course, George told, you know, his farewell address when he left the presidency in 1799, I think, you know. So this is a theme throughout American history, you know. To me, George learned that from his brother, because this was essentially a foreign war. They were in, you know, the Caribbean fighting on Spanish territory. So, mm-hmm. Yeah. So it was a terrible experience for the American. And again, something like a 90% attrition rate. It's like, in those days, people just dropped like flies. You know, the attrition was bad. They were susceptible to yellow fever, which is ultimately what defeated England. So getting back to my, you know, the main points of the war, there were three fronts. There was the Caribbean front, in which the American Legion participated. That was the Battle of Cartagena. That was the attack of Portobello and other little battles in the Caribbean. So the second front was in Georgia with Oglethorpe, the founder of Georgia. When Spain won and beat the British at Cartagena, they were so astonished that they said, well, we can beat them on the continent. So they wanted to take Georgia back. Georgia had been a Spanish colony called Guale, and Spain couldn't administer it. They didn't have the men or the money to administer the colony, so they gradually withdrew. But they never let go of their claim to Georgia. Now, it was this empty land. It was called the Debatable Land. And Oglethorpe went to Georgia, founded Savannah as a colony for worthy debtors. And so Spain determined to take it back. And that's the second front, in the battle for Georgia. And the third front is in the Pacific, as we were discussing Anson's, essentially a glorified raid on Spanish possessions.
I'd imagine it would just be a hotbed of malaria fighting in Spanish Florida at that time.
It was a disaster. I mean, it was yellow fever that got them. Mm. And which I guess is a related disease. But so I want to talk briefly about the main event of this war, which is the Battle of Cartagena. So Cartagena was the Spanish had one great talent. They knew how to fortify a city. They knew how to pick the right location for an easily defensible settlement. Now, Cartagena is located on the far end of a lagoon that is protected, you know, from the outer Caribbean by reefs and by, you know, et cetera, by an island called Tierra Bomba. So Admiral Vernon was in charge of this expedition. He was the great hero of the British because he had taken Portobello, which nobody thought that they could do. Portobello had this reputation of being so well defended that it would take 8,000 men to take the city. And he took the city. He famously boasted, I could take Portobello with 6 ships only, you know, which he did. So he became an overnight celebrity when that news reached England. And in any case, however, he had experience fighting in the Caribbean, and he knew that the longer you lingered, as he said, on those malarial coasts, the more you were going to die. And so he wanted to keep it to a naval war. Now, the Admiralty and the Council of War back in London said, no, we have to have troops on the ground, because they had a wider ambition to take the continent of South America, you know, from Spain. So he said, you have at maximum 6 weeks, then all your men will start dying. Okay. They wouldn't listen to him. You know, they called him the angry admiral. He would scream at people and curse at them and write them angry letters. You know, he was not a diplomat, but he was a damn good soldier, you know. So, however, at Cartagena, he was up against his exact opposite, a guy just as tough as he was, if not tougher, a Spanish admiral named Blas de Lezo. Now, Blas de Lezo, they called him El Medio Hombre, which means the half man, because he had one arm, one leg, one hand, one eye. You know, he lost all these parts of his body fighting for Spain since 1700. So he was in his 50s. Anyway, so he realized. Now, the British sent really what would have been what was an overwhelming armada, something like 20,000 sailors, you know, Marines, including the Americans who were used on ships as Marines, you know, to take Cartagena. Cartagena could, at that time, could only muster 1,800 defenders. Now, Blas de Lezo knew The rainy season was coming. Disease would start getting the Brits. And so he contested every strong point until the last minute. Then he would withdraw to the next strong point. You know, it was a delaying tactic. And so he delayed them until they really started dying. And they were, 13,000 of them died from, it was just, and the rest were sick. They didn't have the strength in the end to take Cartagena, because this is the big problem. There was a divided command structure. Vernon had command of the Navy, and General Wentworth, who was just the worst, had command of the Army, and he wouldn't advance quickly. He did it all by the book. You dug trenches, and if you're fighting a war in Europe, you dug trenches, you set up a very careful battery. Vernon knew that in the Caribbean, you had to take it in a rush. You didn't have the time, So anyways, they lost that conflict because of that battle and because everybody died of yellow fever. And they lost, essentially, the scorecard is kind of even. The Spanish were kicked out of Georgia by Oglethorpe. Anson did succeed in his capture of the, Nuestra Señora de Covadonga, the treasure galleon. But the greatest ambition was thwarted to take South America.
Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors. There's a lot of really interesting what ifs and things that hinge on this war, mentioning the possibility of Britain capturing essentially the entire New World outside of Portuguese possessions and some other rump colonies. But let's talk about the effects of this, because this seems like it is really shifting the course of the 18th century. So what changes as a result of this war?
It's part of, really the big change was in the psyche of the American colonists. It was the dawning of them realizing, Great Britain really is not on the side of the Americans, And in fact, it is from this point that the term Americans starts being used to distinguish the colonial troops from the British regular, those are the Americans. Before that, they were British subjects. They were considered to be British. Then they became Americans. Now that's a huge shift. But it was a 100-year conflict between France, Spain, and England over the New World. And this was one of those, it was a war, but it was one of the battles in that vast conflict that lasted, say from 1700 to the revolution. Now, I think Britain, one of the things Britain did realize was how to fight a war with a command structure that was not divided. And this was very, you had to have a unified, you had to have somebody at the top telling everybody what to do, And because they eventually realized this, they took Canada from the French, they took India from the French. They actually sort of never ventured into South America, again, because of the diseases. They realized, oh man, there's nothing we can do. But the French, they really kind of beat up on over the next 50 years or so. The French and Indian War happens just literally 10 years or so after this. And then the Revolution. Now, in the Revolution, you'll note that the enemies of England, France and Spain, joined with the Americans. And that joining is what defeated England in the Revolution.
Connecting these two things together, this war, the War of Jenkins' Ear, and the Revolution, how would you characterize their connection? Is the Revolution sort of a resolution of what began with the War of Jenkins' Ear?
I would say there is a direct line to be drawn, from the War of Jenkins' Ear to the Revolution. And indeed, some of the same characters fought in, they were old men by the time they hit the Revolution. But, and of course, George Washington's brother, that which was really the most, George Washington, austere figure on our dollar bill, who, this is a question I have a friend who is a collateral descendant of George Washington. So he lives out near Mount Vernon. Oh, and I should mention that Mount Vernon is named after Admiral Vernon, who was Lawrence Washington's commander in the War of Jenkins' Ear. Why did Lawrence name it after you know, a British commander, because he attributed his survival to Admiral Vernon. So a lot of the American troops got there was they were supposed to fight on land, but they got stationed on ships as sailors and Marines. That's what happened. This was a step down. They complained bitterly about this. Now, Admiral Vernon was known for his cleanliness at a time when these ships were often just disgusting. You know, they were just filthy. So once a week, he would have his sailors swab the decks down with vinegar, make sure all the slops are thrown out, et cetera. You know, so his flagship was spotless. It just so happened that Lawrence was stationed on that ship. And to that, he attributes his survival. So that's why he named Mount Vernon after Admiral Vernon. Or one of the, he also respected him because Admiral Vernon was such a kick-ass kind of guy.
Yeah, that too. I mean, it never hurts. The other factor too, the character of the Caribbean in the 18th century and its being a notorious site of piracy. I mean, in some ways that would be unavoidable with all the rich trade happening there, the different islands and alcoves that you can hide out and run to. Does this war have an effect of piracy of training seamen and naval officers to prey on other ships, or was that something that was already baked in? Or
so that's in the previous generation.
Okay.
So at this point, piracy, the golden age of piracy is done. You know, there are still some pirates, but, you know, the great age where you had, you know, Captain Blackbeard and Bartholomew Roberts and those guys, you know, that's 1718, for example, was when Blackbeard was, you know, decapitated and off of Oak Croak Island, where I go every summer for my beach vacation. You know, so that is, say, 1715, you know, really the War of Spanish Succession trained those men. Mm-hmm. 1715 to about 1730, say. So that's the golden age of piracy. I mean, maybe also, you know, earlier in the late 17th century, that piracy was largely in the Indian Ocean. We forget that there was a lot of piracy, you know, preying on the Mughal fleets, you know, of the Indians, you know. But so not really, I guess, is the answer. Mm-hmm. Piracy's, the great pirates are in their graves, by their watery graves. There were a few around. One of them volunteered to help the British in the War of Jenkins' Ear and was actually very effective, George Lowther. He was a pirate and knew the coasts of the Spanish Main intimately, so advised the British for a pardon.
The war between, or the line between pirate and naval commander is always very thin, sometimes non-existent, especially when you're far away from the motherland. There's a lot to explore in this battle, but to wrap things up, there was a point you made that in some ways, this is the first American war and that people are called Americans the first time. And this is creating attitudes about Britain and the colonists and their relation to it that is going to come to fruition later. But also, how do you characterize this in your book as the first time American armies are involved? Other than calling themselves American, how would you characterize them as being American armies?
Well, I mean, they were raised exclusively in the colonies. They were, now Americans, well, colonists, British colonists, because that's what they were, had fought with regular English regiments in the past, but as militia. So this regiment was raised on the establishment, which means that it's paid for, outfitted from London. So these are regular British troops, you know, so they were an American, a regular British regiment filled out with Americans. And they represented, you know, at that time, kind of all the diversity of the colonies. There were Indian scouts. There were free blacks. There were a lot of Irishmen, you know, who they really hated. At the time, the anti-Catholic stuff was just rife. And, you know, there were all these complaints back to England, you know, that the American regiment was full of papists, Irish papists, you know, this kind of stuff. So it was a diverse army raised in the colonies and sort of characteristic of what was of the riffraff that was, you know, peopling the colonies. There were a lot of kind of convicts, you know, looking to escape their legal issues, you know, a lot of debtors and such. So, yeah. They were a rough and ready kind of crew and not really trained at all and not able to fight in that traditional manner where you form up in regiment, in, you know, lines and, you know, first rank fire, second rank, you know, they were really guerrilla. I mean, our talents here were always, you know, in the guerrilla Indian fighting kind of aspect of war, which we honed over several centuries in the wilderness.
Well, this is a good way to explore what's happening in the new world and to not just jump from the 1600s to the 1770s, of which there's a tremendous change that does happen. And this is a good way to show that and then also show what is causing those changes to happen. So there's a lot more to this story, and naval history is very interesting in this time. It's such a transitional period, and I think this is a great gateway to that and other things going on, which we discuss in this episode. So for listeners who want to explore more, the name of your book is The War of Jenkins' Ear, The Forgotten Struggle for North and South America, 1739 to 1742. Robert, thank you for joining us.
Hey, thanks. I hope that was coherent. Was that
okay. All right. That is all for today. If you'd like to see show notes for this episode and all my other episodes, go to ParthenonPodcast.com. That's the name of the podcast network that this show is a part of, along with other great history shows like Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen and History of the Papacy, James Early's Key Battles of American History, and other shows as well. If you'd like to support this show, there are two easy ways to do so. The first is to subscribe to History Unplugged on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. The second thing is to join the show's membership program. It's on Patreon, and if you go to patreon.com/unplugged and join it, as a member, you'll get completely ad-free episodes of the show's entire back catalog, which is 600 episodes and growing. Just go to patreon.com/unplugged. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.